Hey, howdy. Hey, my Bruin brothers and sisters. I'm here live with another episode of Brew Strong and my good friend, Scott Janish from scottjanish.com.
It's time and for the Sapwood
Brewery out in the East Coast, Maryland, where everybody is merry. It's the merry land. Just got finished with the show, and so now we're moving on to more hop stuff. Scott, tell people that maybe this is their first show that they've seen you on. Tell them a little bit about yourself, how you got started in this whole hop book writing thing.
Well, it's the my intro into homebrewing is probably the same story that most people have. But mine was the homebrew kit thing, and I still remember the first batch I did because it tasted so bad. It tasted like soap. and I always say, I think that's why I was just like, didn't give it up. Like it was so bad. I knew I could do better. And so I just kept like, come on, I can do better than this. But had that first batch been good, I might've just been like, all right, good. We'll check that one off the box. I don't need to do that anymore.
Yep. I think having a bad first homebrew batch, especially if you've tasted great homebrew, it kind of teaches you just like, well, wait a minute. You know, Bob over here made great homebrew.
Yeah.
I'm making bad homebrew. All right. You know, versus if you're comparing it to the greatest commercial beer you ever had, you might be like, I can't do it. They've got advantages, you know, over me with their commercial gear. Right.
Right. That's kind of how I got started, and then just sort of moved on from, oh, it's cool that I can make beer at home, to, all right, let's really try to make beer at home. And got pretty serious about it and started a blog mostly inspired by, you know, Mike's Mad Fermentationist blog at the time, honestly. Cause I appreciated people putting their process and, you know, recipes out for the world to read and then having honest feedback from them. You know, mm-hmm. I think one of my favorite parts of Mike's blog is if he didn't like the beer, it was pretty clear he didn't like it, but he still wrote about it. I trusted him more because of that, and it mm-hmm. was almostly, you know, what you don't like is sometimes just as important as what you do when you're brewing. And so so inspired by that, I started blogging, and then that just kind of grew into, you know, the academic blogging to a book. So it was a slow organic process, but
speaking of things I don't like and do like, my good friend John Blickman at BlickmanEngineering.com. Yeah, you've probably seen that gear in your local homebrew shop. You probably drooled over it. Somebody in your club may have a Blickman Engineering piece of equipment. Heck, even your local microbrewery is probably running a Blickman Engineering system. Or if they're not, they're missing out. If you're thinking of opening a small brewery or something like that, you do yourself justice to check out Blickman Engineering. They are making the good thing about them is, I will tell you this, I've known John Blickman for 20 years, whatever. And the most important thing in the world to him is that if you buy a piece of equipment from them, that you're going to be satisfied, that it's actually going to make your brewing day easier, better, your process better. It's going to help you in some way. And if it's not, he doesn't want to sell you anything. it's just the way this guy is. He's wonderful. So in his quest to help the brewing community, he sponsors this show because for some reason, he probably only listened to a show where we have lots of good information. He didn't listen to the show where I talked about my testicles or anything like that. So that's why he still sponsors this show. And what I need you to do is not talk about the testicle thing, but to email feedback@blickmanengineering.com and explain to him that this show is a valuable piece of resource and you appreciate that he has sponsored it. So check them out, BlickmanEngineering.com. And like I said, John Blickman is just a wonderful human being and very kind and helpful to homebrewers and pro brewers everywhere. So check them out. All right. So today we are talking about survivables. And I thought that this was fascinating. See, I read ScottJanisch.com because there's a ton of great information on there. And I, you know, maybe you don't have the answer to everything, but you pose a lot of interesting questions. And one of them is, you know, what survives kind of the hot side of the brew process that really becomes hoppy? This is one of the things that has kind of irked me for a long time. And maybe I'm totally wrong, but it's that, you know, first wort hopping or mash hopping. You know, the claim that first wort hopping, well, there's some compound or something at temperature in the wort, and it's the same compounds that are in later in the wort. It's just you're exposing the hops for a longer period of time. And then and then people would point to, well, the Germans write about, you know, a finer hop flavor. The Germans don't want hop flavor. They want, when they're talking about flavor, they're talking about bitterness, a smoother, cleaner bitterness, getting rid of a lot of the volatile compounds that have a lot of the characteristic, you know, characters, maybe caddy or whatever, that you don't want in the hops. In a fine German beer, you want a clean, perfect bitterness without this extraneous hop flavor. And I think that's what they were looking for when they talked about first wort hopping. Unfortunately, you know, then we in America grab hold of this and go, well, it says it's better flavor. You get more hop flavor if you put them in the first wort. And for me, I thought that was, it was not the the smartest thing. You know, what's your thought on first wort hopping? Let's throw that out there. Let's touch this live rail.
It's funny because it's always hard to define, you know, smoother flavor, you know, too. It's just, you know, what exactly do you mean by that? And can you even tell? Because I would think, you know, most of the hop compounds that you're after in terms of if we're staying on, like, you know, hazy beers or even West Coast IPAs, most of those monoterpene alcohols and everything you want in the finished beer are going to be long gone if you're first wort hopping. I mean, a 60-minute boil, I think, is probably pushing out most of those compounds. In fact, you know, hydrocarbons like myrcene, for example, are gone in a matter of minutes in hot wort. So I don't think flavor-wise, I don't think I would be able to tell much of a difference between a 60-minute and a first wort addition.
There's the magic that happens, though, because you're first wort hopping. What about that magic?
Your beer smells better sooner while you're brewing.
Right. Yeah, I can be totally wrong. I often am. I think that's what I'm really well known for. If you Google, you know, I think that's the case.
I will say, though, we do a lot of mash hopping at Southwood.
Okay.
More of a beer stability thing based off some research that shows that alpha acids and beta acids introduced to the wort have an ability to complex problematic metals that come from the grain. So, you know, if there's iron or copper, it can kind of reduce those total numbers right away. And in fact, the alpha acids have a better ability to do that at higher pHs. And so if you mash hop, even before you make an adjustment to your mash to lower that pH, you might get an even quicker impact on that. And so for us, it's more of a insurance, you know, if it works and we're getting a little bit better stability out of it, especially with hazy beers, which, you know, have a tendency to go downhill a little faster than others.
Right.
We just don't see a reason not to throw in a pound or two in the mash, but otherwise,
a pound or two in how big a mash?
So that's a 10 barrel batch.
Mm-hmm.
So an ounce or so for a home brewer. And usually we're just, you know, stealing from the whirlpool or
if
we have a bag open, from a previous use that we have in the cold room, we'll just, you know, toss those in.
I've also believed that, you know, in dark beers, you know, those roasted grains, it's the, you know, has an antioxidant property to it that actually helps. But then there's the whole thing about the heat load on your entire beer becomes a negative. Like a lot of crystal malts, affects the stability. But I think, that was another show we did. You're going to have to go back and Google and listen more. All right. So what do you mean by survivable hops?
Survivables is it's a term that Yakima Chief just was kind of throwing around, I guess, internally while they're doing some research in it. And it's one that I just kind of adopted with them because I really like it. It describes kind of what they're after, what they're researching. But, there's, over 1,000 different compounds in hops. Mm-hmm. It's a little overwhelming to really dive into all of them.
Right.
So why not just focus on the compounds we know are in the final beer? Mm-hmm. those are they're having an impact on the taste and aroma because they're there. We can test them. And so why not focus all the research on those? And that's kind of what they did in a recent study. But you almost have to step back a little bit and then kind of define what those classes of hop compounds are to see, or at least for me, it's helpful to step back and look at those because then you have a better sense of what each compound might be bringing to the beer and why it's important that it's in there.
All right.
And so, for the longest time, most of the research focused on monoterpene alcohols. So these aren't the hydrocarbons. So those hydrocarbons are, again, like the myrcene type compounds that are more volatile. And those on hot side wise, I don't think they're sticking around at all. So mm-hmm. they didn't focus at all on those. But they did look at the monoterpene alcohols that are found in finished beer, like linalool, geraniol, beta citronella, those kind of things.
Right.
And those historically have been the compounds that most of the research has been focused on. I mean, linalool, for example, most papers, they determine the hoppiness amount by how much linalool is in there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's been like the magic compound for a while. And so that was one they looked at. And then they also looked at the two newer areas that are interesting to me are hop-derived esters and mm-hmm. hop-derived fatty acids.
Okay. Well, let's do this. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll dive into more of survivable hops right after this.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking survivables with Scott Janisch from Scott Janisch IPA and Sapwood Brewery and author of the excellent new IPA book that gives you a lot of information about brewing with hops. All right, so we're talking about survivable hops, hops that make it through the hot process into the cold process and, why that's important. One of the things I thought was interesting in the article on your website, scottjanisch.com, was you mentioned the importance of tasting beers pre-dry hop. And why is that?
Yeah, it's kind of like an obsession I have with these with our hoppy beers because, if you taste your beer, so fermentation's done, you had a healthy, good fermentation, there's no off flavors. You crash out the yeast if you have that ability. I know it's harder as a home brewer. And then so right before adding the hops, I like to pull a sample, adding the dry hops that is, pull a sample and really smell it and try to analyze the aroma and the flavor that I'm getting from it. Because so often when I use, we're whirlpooling at about 2 pounds per barrel in most of our beers, which is pretty high from my understanding with a lot of other pro breweries around us anyways. And a lot of times there's like almost no hop flavor at that point. So mm-hmm. fermentation itself pushed it off through CO2. You lose some compounds to trub. It's just for whatever reason, certain hops would have hardly any impact, on the final flavor before dry hopping. And some just seem to stick around really well. And so we're always trying new hops, because it's great when you get a lot of hop flavor from a hop that's cheap. So you can just load up the hot side with those.
Right.
And so that's why we have like the cheater hops is what we dub like a series of, like, you know, Citra, the Galaxies of the world. And then the cheaper hops are just like the Cascade, Columbus of the world. And so for me, it all kind of started with Idaho 7. That was the one hop about a year ago that we used in the Whirlpool. And that's, you know, probably around, I think that was all Idaho 7. So 2 pounds per barrel or so. So, probably about 10 ounces. I'd have to do the math for a home brewer there. But right before dry hopping, I couldn't believe how aromatic the beer was. It had like a nice piney kind of fruitiness to it. And the flavor was there too. So I really had no idea why that was happening. But Yakima Chief just recently, you know, dissected the Idaho 7 in particular to see, you know, what was in it. And it turns out that it just has the highest percentage of these compounds that are sticking around. So it has the highest amount of these survivable compounds that they know are in finished beer, and the hop itself before it goes into the beer has a lot of them.
So what compounds are those? I mean, what, you know, if we're looking at other hops to try and determine what's the next great Idaho 7 for survivable hop compounds, What compounds are there? I think you listed four things: oxygen containing monoterpene alcohols, hop derived esters, branch chain fatty acids, and polyfunctional thiols. Right?
Yeah, that's
okay.
That's the, you know, and each one of those has an individual. So those are more like classes of hop compounds, and then you can break those down into more. In terms, you know, a lot. These aren't usually on the, you know, wherever you're buying the hops, they usually don't get into that much detail. Hopefully, you know, at some point they will.
They don't give you any analysis whatsoever. They're like, alpha acid, harvested this date. It's like, do you have any more? They're like, no. Like,
some
thanks.
Of them are doing better now at like telling like the lots, or I think a lot of homebrew packs you can look up now. I'm not 100%
sure. A little more. I mean, it's hard even to get oil content sometimes.
Yeah.
Total oil content. It's like, well, yeah, all right.
That means it has a lot of oil. It has a lot of whatever it has if it's high.
Yeah, it's got something in it. Right.
Yeah. So, but so for the hop derived esters, the big one is 2-MIB is the name of it. It's like a apricot forward flavor. And the individual hops that are higher in that would be like a Southern Cross. Hop-derived fatty acids is another one. And that's, fatty acids are almost like a precursor to esters. During fermentation, fatty acids get converted into fruity esters, but sometimes they stick around as well. And so Bravo and Apollo are the two that stand out of this paper. I think tested 12 different hop varieties, and they were high in those. And those are important because, you know, hop there's so many, it's easy to get almost too confused with all this because there's so many compounds, but it seems that trying to load up your whirlpool with the most complex set of them is kind of the key, because synergy is a big part of this. So they found that the more like hop drive fatty acids were in the beer, it had an additive impact on the fruity monoterpene alcohols. So by dosing in some of these fatty acids, it tasted like there was more of the monoterpene alcohols. You know, it's just a synergistic effect. And they had the same thing with thiols. So, you know, hop drive thiols, the main ones are, you know, 3-MH, 3-MHA, and 4-MMP. And they just found that whenever there was 4-MMP, for example, in with the monoterpene alcohols, the monoterpene alcohols tasted like there was more of them. And so it's more of a, you know, just because Southern Cross is high in, you know, a hop drive ester 2-MIB doesn't mean you should just only use Southern Cross.
Right.
It's just, you know, they're all kind of additive and they work together.
Right. You know, the It's interesting. So a friend of mine, Travis, TC from Houston, he will do a lot of smash beers, you know, single malt, single hop. And, you know, he does it with all these hops that he's getting. And just recently he sent me some finally. And they were delicious, by the way. But, you know, it's a great, you know, indicator of an individual hop. But I have it's difficult for me to appreciate a single hop beer. I because there's always a better beer that uses that hop with some other hop. Yeah. It's like you're saying the synergy of using multiple hops really, you know, brings out so much more. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts when you use multiple hops and you use that in that collaboration. That's why I like that kind of database you have on your website that kind of sorts hops by, you know, the compounds in them. It's interesting because it's like, okay, it's like layering, you know, flavors on when you're cooking. You're trying to build something more than just, you know, cooking a steak. When you cook a steak, you add other flavors to it because a little bit of salt, a little bit of pepper, all of a sudden, oh my God, you know, you got something more, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting too, that I think you can go too much the other way. I don't know what your experience is, but right. if you start layering, you know, even three sometimes for me is too many hops in one beer, but
sure,
if you're going
sure.
four or five, six different varieties. To me, I just tend to get more of a generic hoppiness.
Yes.
Yeah. And so you can go too high, the other way by trying to be too diverse. So, you know, usually we're doing, I think I mentioned in the last show, whenever we do single hop beers, we almost always do cryo with the pellet version because it builds in a little more complexity because you're having a different set of, I mean, the same amount, you're having different amounts of those oils. And so they're similar in nature, but they're pelletized so much differently.
Right.
Usually, yeah, two varieties is kind of where I like to go. And trying out a new variety, I almost always pair it with Citra because Citra just goes well with everything. So you can have a
Citra is king. Yes. Yeah. I'll do three generally. But that's, you know, something in the kettle that is really just, you know, more of a background and then, you know, a couple in the dry hop. And it depends, I guess, you know, when I do something like a classic German Pilsner or something like that, or some of those other beers, I will do, you know, a single hop in a lot of those.
I guess when I say like two, I'm talking just dry hopping. So the hot side, we'll use multiple varieties because that's where we're just trying to load it up with as many compounds as we can. But yeah, dry hopping is usually one to three for us. I don't know. Do you ever do, if you're doing three, do you change the amounts or you just split them up evenly?
We'll change the amounts.
Yeah,
it depends. You know what we want more character from. You know, we kind of, I don't know. You brew long enough, and you kind of have this sense of, yeah, a little more of that, a little less of that. You don't have any scientific proof. You don't have any, you know, detailed logs and spreadsheets of analysis. You just go like, yeah, a little more of this, a little less of that. Yeah, throw it in here, throw it in there, and you know, Bob's your uncle. There you go.
Whichever hop costs more, you just dry hop with that one last, so it sticks around.
Exactly. That's the problem with commercial brewing. Let's see here. If you have any questions, you can enter them into the comments on Facebook. Yeah, this is all live, and the beautiful Beverly Moore, Bevo, is there monitoring your chat, and she is providing those questions to us. And a reminder, we're going to do this live every week on Wednesday, starting 1 p.m. Pacific, until I catch up with all the shows that we should have been doing the last 6 months. I apologize to our sponsors and our listeners. I don't really apologize to Justin because that does no good. Bevo, I would apologize to. She is too sweet and too kind. Let's see. She says, Julia says, survivables. Can coriander, with loads of linalool and some geraniol be used in the whirlpool as a substitute for hops. For example, in a sour with lacto yeast co-fermentation to prevent killing the lacto with hop alpha acids. Oh, interesting. If so, how much grams per liter coriander would you recommend? So this is a fascinating question. Obviously, Julius understands a lot of what's going on. You know, we talk about linalool, geraniol being biotransformed, being part of, you know, making a juicy beer, but he's mixing in also, you know, on a sour beer, when you have lactobacillus that is harmed by hop alpha acids, could you use coriander? All right, Scott, you're on the must answer this question.
We've done it. So Mike has done. I believe he wrote a blog post years ago about using coriander for its high geraniol composition to see if you could get biotransformation, because that's one of those, again, that we know sac strains do. You don't need a different enzyme that mm-hmm. like wine yeast or Brett are capable of doing. And so we have a goza that we've done twice now, where we add coriander to the fermenter at the same time we pitch yeast. Again, because that biotransformation is happening in the first couple of days of fermentation, so we're just trying to get that geraniol in there early. Mm-hmm. I don't know off the top of my head what our rate was for using it, but it turns out well, because it really shifts the coriander to more of like a citrusy lime kind of flavor, mm-hmm. and away from something, you know, you might have in your cupboard. And so it works really well for us. And it's more of like it's not a dominant flavor. It's just more kind of in there for complexity. And then that beer too, generally we have, you know, we're co-pitching most of our beers have lacto in them. We're keeping alive. Unless we're going to, you know, have the mobile canners come through, then we have to kill it off and then the kettle.
Right.
We're pitching lacto at the same time as sac, or giving lacto a 24-hour head start before pitching some yeast.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turns out pretty well in our beer when we take that approach that he was mentioning.
Is it possibly a less expensive way of getting linalool, geraniol in your wort in the whirlpool for juicy beers?
Probably, yeah. I don't know the cost per, you know, ounce of coriander per, you know, some good.
I don't know if you know this, but I'm a cheap bastard. So I'm going to figure that out. I'm going to see if I can do it. And maybe I'll try 120 barrel batch with coriander instead. I will tell you this.
Coriander beer.
There's a huge difference in the types of coriander available. And I learned this at Sipsmith in London. They make gin. And we were doing a collab with, I was making a goza at Fuller's, 250 British barrels. and we threw in lactobacillus in their facility and everything else. And they thought we'd lost our minds. But
hopefully they got that lacto out of their facility. It's
absolutely the greatest collab ever. They left me to run the brew plant when a tour was coming through. It was so much fun. But we couldn't get coriander for some reason. We walked across the street to Sipsmith, which is in the Fuller's parking lot. And they make amazing gins. And they gave us some coriander. And it was a smaller coriander seed. And what I've found is the smaller the coriander seed, the more citrus it seems to have. The bigger the coriander seed, it becomes much more black pepper. Yeah. So if you're looking at coriander seeds, look for the smallest coriander seeds. They tend to be far more citrusy. I mean, it was just night and day. So that's that. And I wonder, have they done a study of coriander seed size versus linalool and geraniol concentration?
There was a study on using that a while back.
Oh, yeah.
And I agree with you that the, I think we get ours from a place, I don't know if it's like a, just local to us, called like H Mart, I think is where we get a lot of this stuff, but they
Dollar Tree.
Yeah. Dollar Tree. That's where you get the best coriander.
Oh yeah.
But there's a huge difference. The one that we use, it smells almost more like fruity pebbles or something than, and so it the ingredients you put in your beer definitely is a huge impact.
It's not, definitely makes a difference.
Yeah.
Todd was asking, he wants us to discuss how terrible wet hop beers are in the same fashion.
What? We don't get a lot of opportunities to do wet hop beers on the East Coast. There's not as, you know, the turnaround to get them to us isn't as quick. And there's some hop growing around us, but we're, I don't have direct lines on a lot of these things. But yeah, I don't know what your opinion is wet hop beers, but they do seem a little greener in nature than.
Yes, you have to enjoy that, you know, chewing on a leaf. Kind of chewing on cabbage before it's fully ripe or too ripe.
I love the concept character. Of wet hop beers.
Yeah. I love it, you know, because it's not like something you get all the time. And it really does depict, you know, kind of the character of the hop before it's fully, you know, dry and, you know, how you use it later on. It accentuates that chlorophyll and the kind of that green, yeah. You know, raw kind of vegetable character. And, you know, it's cool. And I like anything that was well fermented. So, yeah. You know, you can throw that in there and it's not that bad for me.
I'd be curious to try a wet hop beer where the wet hops were added like day one of fermentation. And, you know, maybe something like greener character thing that would blow off a little bit, and maybe you'd be left with some of the more polar, fruitier compounds. But mm-hmm. you know, that's mm-hmm. not something I've tried, but that would be right. an interesting thing to do.
Yeah, once a year thing. We're gonna need to take another short break. If you're listening live, stay tuned. We're gonna be back in just a few seconds. If you're listening on the podcast, enjoy listening to our fine sponsors. Make sure to support them. We will be back right after this.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. Live with Bruce Strong and Scott Janish from scottjanish.com and Sapwood Brewery out in Maryland. We've been talking about survivables, which is what hop compounds are surviving the process of the boil or the whirlpool, the hot side, that make it to the cold side. And surprisingly, Scott's pointed out that like Idaho 7 has like the greatest survivability of the hot side into the cold side. Which hops are better survivors? And break this down for me from like the boil, the whirlpool, and even dry hopping. Which ones are we looking for each phase of our brewing?
Well, the if I just point to like the Yakima Chief study that was done recently, where they,
you know, you have a great chart on your website as well.
Yep, and that's coming straight from them, where they did I think it was 6 or 7 of these survivable compounds. So it's a mix of monoterpene alcohols, hop drive esters, and thiols. And looked at each hop variety to see, you know, which ones are having, you know, the most of the combination of these important survivable compounds. And Idaho 7, like we said, was number one. We've actually found that when we're using Idaho 7 as in the whirlpool, we'd like to use it as like half of it, because it can almost be too much and interfere with some of the especially more subtle dry hop varieties. Mm-hmm. But Mosaic was number two. Mosaic is another one that we use quite a bit on the hop side, actually paired with Idaho 7 quite a bit.
Wow. Yeah.
And Bravo is one that was number three. And that's an interesting one because Bravo is high in these, in total oil. It's high in monoterpene alcohols. And so if it's high in total oil and monoterpene alcohols, it just means kind of it has more of those. It was also high in some of the hop drive esters. And so it's just like one of those that kind of hits all the check marks individually for some of these compounds. So it makes sense that that's, that it's up there. Millennium is one that I haven't used yet that I would really like to. That's also high. Simcoe. You know, I'm interested in, so one of the hop styles is 3MH, which is like a grapefruit type thiol that, and thiols I should say are just, you know, they're sulfur compounds in hops and they're very, very small percentage of the total oil, but their thresholds, the sensory thresholds are really low. And so you don't need a lot of them in there to actually have an impact on the beer. And 3MH is one that gets converted to 3MHA, which is like a passion fruit one with the right yeast and right enzyme. But on its own, it's good as like a grapefruit thing. But that was one of the only compounds that actually was tested to increase with time in the boil. So it would make sense to me to use the hops that are high in 3MH as like your bittering addition if you're doing that. Because if that 3MH is going to keep increasing, you increase the chance of that being converted potentially to a passion fruit thing, or you're just increasing more of that beneficial, survivable compound. And Millennium is one that was really high in that. And so that's one I'm plan on experimenting with in a little bit here. So, and that's kind of the thing with all this. It's like the science is just fun to help steer us to try new things with a little intention. It doesn't mean it's always going to pan out.
A little purpose, giving something a shot, and here's the reason why. You know, it's the purpose of any scientific study. It's like, well, here's my theory. You know, the high levels of 4-MMP are going to lead to, you know, this, that, the other thing. And so I'm going to use a hop with that. And that's my theory. And I'm going to prove it, disprove it. Yeah. Absolutely fantastic. So Millennium, you would suggest for the boil, right?
Yeah.
If you're trying to get the passion fruit or something like that, right?
Yeah, anything that's high in that 3MH. Otherwise, 3MH. The Whirlpool is really where it's at for all these compounds. I mean, I think you're going to have higher retention of all these in the Whirlpool. Probably even if you have the ability to cool your Whirlpool a little bit before adding the hops, I think you would increase that even more.
Right. You suggest 180 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yep, that's what we tend to shoot for most of ours. And if we go a little lower, we might increase the time, the contact time there. But so, you know, usually 180 degrees, 2 pounds per barrel, probably around 10 ounces for a home brewer, and then at least 20 minutes or so of contact time at 180.
And then in dry hopping, is there like a difference, you know, survivability in the dry hopping versus are there hops that survive dry hopping better?
I guess, you know, dry hopping is interesting because, you know, if you're doing it post-fermentation, and especially if you're doing it under pressure, so you have, you know, 5 pounds of pressure on the headspace or something, there's not a lot of variables that should detract from those compounds that extract, if that makes sense. I mean, fermentation is done. You're at a cooler temperature, so you're not worried about heat pushing any aromatics or compounds out. So I think at that point, it's more of what flavor profile are you after, and then sort of targeting hops based on that. You can use a little of the science to guide you in terms of pushing yourself away from more greener compounds, especially in these hazy beers that we discussed, for more viscous and retain some of those otherwise more volatile green compounds. But that might be one thing to consider. But I think overall it'd be, they're probably, you know, whatever the, what is in that hop in terms of their oil makeup is probably just being extracted in a similar manner post-firm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, which goes to, you know, the hops that are, that we've added in the whirlpool or the boil, those compounds need to survive fermentation. Is there a difference in which hops survive fermentation better or in which yeasts promote certain flavors? I think yeast has an incredible impact on what the finished beer is and will take away your hops, give you hops, take away your malts. You know, it has the ability to do a lot. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I 100% agree. There was a new paper that came out. I think they tested maybe 10 different yeast strains. And they basically, it was the same beer, but they used different yeast strains with the same hops. And then they had drastically different final compound measurements for each one of those yeasts. So mm-hmm. some yeasts are leaving some, you know, potentially beneficial compounds behind more than others. And the one that this paper found, of course, this was only studying a handful of yeast strains, so it doesn't mean it's the best, but S33 and what is it? K97. So these are dry yeast strains. They had the highest amount of, by far the highest of these apricot leaning hop derived esters in the final beer. Mm-hmm. And the sensory panel also found them to be the most aromatic in terms of fruity flavors. So mm-hmm. I think yeast strain is so huge in brewing. And that's
great.
You know, that we just brewed a beer that had 3% Hefeweizen yeast mm-hmm. as part of like normal, like 13-18 type primary ferment. Uh-huh. It doesn't take much at all to kind of, to get that, to completely change your profile of your beer with just a little bit more of another yeast strain.
Right. Right.
And so I love playing with different blends. I've done a lot of co-ferments with wine yeast. So I'll do, you know, 5-10% of the yeast pitched with wine yeast that has, you know, enzymes like beta glucosidase that can bioconvert and release additional flavors from hops, the same kind of hops or same compounds that, you know, the wine world has been looking at for a long time. And it's been tricky because most of the wine yeast leave like a really phenolic aftertaste to the beer. So mm-hmm. maybe there's some bioconversion going on, but I just can't get past the fermentation profile that it's leaving. That's
right. Right.
And so it's, yeah. You know, I've tried 6 or 7 different wine yeasts and almost always it's like that. The only one that I had good luck with was a wine strain called Vin 7. And that was co-pitched with a lager at cooler temperatures, so mm-hmm. As a way to try to tamper down that phenolic thing. But it makes you also paranoid how important cleaning is. If only, you know, 1% or 2 of a different strain and can make a big difference.
Yeah, yeah. Heat is your friend at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's take a short break and hear from our friends who've make the show possible, and we'll be back right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew Strong.
All right, we're back doing Brew Strong with a good friend, Scott Janisch. Let's see here. We were talking about fermentation affecting, you know, the flavor of beer. I mean, that's just a massive thing. And, you know, really the hops that, you know, will, you know, survive kind of fermentation, but it really depends on the yeast. I think, you know, some may last past the yeast, but here's another question I have for you. You're telling me I should take my hops and leave them out, poke holes in the nitrogen sealed bags, leave them out warm sitting around for a year warm or whatever the heck you're talking about. You're telling me you take my valuable hops and abuse them and then throw them in the whirlpool because I'm going to build up the branch chain fatty acids in those hops. And that's going to give me something better. Now, full disclosure, I'm willing to give this a try on a 120 barrel batch. I'm going to go for it. I do have Apollo on hand. I do have Apollo on hand, and I do have a beer that I brew like every week at 120 barrels. So I'm willing to give this a shot. Explain yourself, my friend. Explain yourself.
Well, I'll explain the research of others, so then I'm not on the hook.
Oh, blame it on others.
the hop derived fatty acids. So that's an oxygen actual alpha acids are being oxidized into these fatty acids. So the more you leave them out, the more fatty acids you'll have. So, you know, I wouldn't recommend, like, again, it's not all about these, right? It's, you want some of it. So it's not like, you know, 100% of your whirlpool. I probably wouldn't do super eight. I mean, you just want to push some of those in because they have that synergistic effect that we were talking about earlier. And I actually reached out to the author of this paper because he found that, you know, Apollo was one of those that had the most of these. I think Apollo and Bravo had the most of these fatty acids. And so just on their own, but then if you were to age them a little bit, you'd get even more of them.
Right.
And so I asked him, like, what exactly he meant by that. And his recommendation was, you know, like a year at room temperature, essentially.
Oh my God.
And for me, that just means like, I'm less afraid at the brewery to use hops on the hot side that are just in our cold room. We're in transit for a long time or whatever the case is. I'm more concerned with how hops are treated for the dry hops. And this just makes me feel a little better about, you know, getting poorly treated hot side hops. And a lot of the dry hops that we intend to use that don't smell good. It's like, just because it's in the recipe doesn't mean it's going in the beer.
So we'll
smell them before we use them. If they're not that great, then we'll usually just, you know, put them in the cold room and leave them for a while and then try them on the hot side.
I think a couple of things. One is if I leave a box, if I pierce a bag of Apollo hops and leave it out room temperature for a year, when I go back to use this hop, they're going to smell like cheese and, you know, and if I was throwing them in the boil, if I was giving it 60 minutes to blow off the cheese, maybe. But if you're telling me to throw them in the whirlpool at like 180, I think I'm going to trap a lot of that cheese in my beer. Is that not the case?
Well, I guess I'd have to go back and look. I'm pretty sure he didn't recommend
cheese.
You don't want cheese in the beer.
A little cheddar? Could we cheddar whirlpool? Dry cheddaring.
So you just said it. Now it's probably going to be the next big thing here.
You heard it here first. We had the whirlpool coriander. Now we have the dry cheddaring. We have beers coming out that are going to taste spectacular.
I wouldn't probably poke holes in the bag that I was leaving out for a year unless I was going to use them in like we do a lot of mixed firm beers, lambic inspired beers. That
it's in your blog. You wrote poke some holes. I'm not making this up.
You're right. you don't want like a poorly stored, in my opinion. Like if it smells really awful, I probably wouldn't use it. It's more of like, it's faded a little bit, right? And so like you're not going to use it as a dry hop, but you're still comfortable using it in the whirlpool. It's a little old. It probably has more of these fatty acids that can both be good for synergy and as well as be esterified into fruity esters during fermentation.
So is the oxidative effects developing more of the fatty acids?
Yeah. So the more they're exposed, I believe the more they're exposed to oxygen, the more of these,
the greater the, right. So see, on the end, if you get a ton of them, it smells like rotten cheddar. Just saying.
Yeah.
There you go.
I like how you said you got to cheese them off too. So by not using them in the world. Those would be good ones maybe to use in the mash hopping too, where, you know, some of those,
right.
You know, you still have some alpha acids left in them. So you're getting that stability benefit, and then, uh-huh. You know, you're giving them time to cheese off, but those fatty acids might still carry through a little bit and have a positive impact.
Right. Right. You'll carry the fatty acids through. Okay. No, I'm, no matter how much I joke about it, I'm curious to give it a try. At this point, I have people, which I say, look, do this. And they go like, well, that sounds stupid. Do it anyways. It's like two or three conversations, but eventually I get them to do what I want. And, you know, we try these weird things. So, we'll try dry cheesing or first wort cheesing. Stuart asks, with more and more hop varieties coming in the market every year from Africa, Australia, Eastern Europe, Britain, etc., what non-US hops are lighting your fire? Assuming you have a fire.
I have a fire and hops light it. Let's see which ones do it. I'm trying to think, is it Nectaron? I think they just renamed one of the new
Nectaron.
Yeah,
is it sounds like a Transformer movie.
I know it's a goofy name, but I think it was 4337 maybe was the number that was assigned to it before it was officially Nectaron. But that was a pretty good one. It was Galaxy like in what I've used. To me, Galaxy has like a fruit stripe gum thing when it's really, really good.
Oh, yeah.
It's had a little bit of that. That's one that I really like. And of course, the non-US ones, Galaxy is always way up there for us.
Right.
It's just great. I'm a big fan of like Holler Tower Blanc, especially mixed with a little Mosaic. I think that's a great combo. In fact, that's a combo that we've done with just a little bit of Belgian yeast with too. So little Belgian yeast and Mosaic and Holler Tower Blanc is a fun beer. But there's so many that are always coming out it's hard to track. In fact, I look here, the survivables thing they did, one of the, so it's HBC 692 was pretty high on the list for having a lot of these compounds. So that's another experimental one that might be worth trying on the hot side.
Well, I think, pick some from the high end of this list, pick some others that have other characteristics. You know, it's like you're saying earlier, the synergy of, the hops, mixing hops really helps.
Yeah. You're not putting all your eggs in one basket with one variety because a paper found it was high in one compound.
Right. Right. Exactly. You need multiple compounds.
Yeah.
Samuel was asking, the golden rule for dry hopping is 8 grams per liter as the upper bound. 5 grams per liter for a typical homebrew setup. I think 5-ish. Yeah. Before saturation and money loss. What are Scott's thoughts on if that is for a single dry hop or if that is total dry hop over the course of 2 or 3 days? Is it 8 grams per liter total or per dry hop charge? I will tell you this. If you're homebrewing, you're worried about money loss, just open a commercial brewery. Stop homebrewing. Homebrewing is not about saving money. If you homebrew, you're going to throw money away and you're going to enjoy it and you're going to have the best beer in the world and you're just going to have an amazing time. Homebrewing is not about saving money.
Yeah.
Commercial brewing is about throwing money away. If you're worried about throwing money away and money loss, open a brewery. There you go. So 8 grams per liter, is that the total upper? So
I think
upper limits for dry hopping before. We talked about this earlier. You know, there's a limit to dry hopping where you're wasting hops. I think the Hammer talked about this. What is it? And Jen, I think it's total would be the answer. It's
probably a total figure, I would guess.
Yeah.
It's just so hard to, you know, I would almost hate for there to be an actual golden rule for hopping, because that means everyone's doing the same thing.
Right. Like writing a book of recipes and then everybody's brewing the same recipes and entering a competition. That sucks. What kind of a world is that?
And I actually purposely didn't, you know, despite I'm sure people would love recipes in, I purposely didn't put a single recipe in mine, because the whole point is trying to encourage people to like use the science to be creative.
You have to give people a starting point. Give people a starting point that they can use and, you know, see that it has, you know, that it worked. Yeah. And then they can go from there. And then you can kind of give them the, you know, okay, here's things to try. But you got to give them a starting point. This is the biggest failure of your book.
No recipes.
It was just horrible because of that. I got no recipes out of it. I'm sure you've gotten comments. All right.
Oh, yeah.
So you write a book and then you get comments about, oh, it's horrible because of this. It's horrible because of that. It's just like, oh my God, what? Because I didn't include recipes? Please.
I definitely got a lot.
There was a typo in it.
The early version had weird like spacing and stuff because it was self-published. So I was kind of learning as I was going. And it's like,
right.
But
I honestly think it's a great book. It's one of the few books written by somebody else that I've enjoyed a lot. No, I don't mean that. I love all the books out there. I'm reading a great one, Strange Tales of Ale, by Martin in England. I truly think your book is, everybody who's brewing should have it. It's one of those great books that just really asks a lot of great questions, answers a lot of great questions. I think that is, you know, something pretty special. You don't see those very often.
Well, so. I appreciate that. It means a lot coming from you, especially. So.
Well, there you go. Well, I thank you very much for participating in this. I want to mention our good friends at brewchatter.com. Those guys, they understand great homebrew. They have great ingredients. I'm sure they have Scott's book there in stock for you to go run down and check it out. They're in Sparks, Nevada, right next to Reno. And they're also got, you can order all the stuff from them online, brewchatter.com. Say hi to Josh and RJ for me. Really great guys. And if you want to order Blickman Engineering stuff, they've got it at their place. They can order it for you. They're big on any kind of equipment you want. They can do it. They know. They brew and brew very successfully, so they know what they're doing. Anyways, check them out, brewchatter.com. All right. Thanks again, Scott. This has been very enjoyable and I think very educational for me and for the listeners. And hope to have you back again soon, or maybe we'll collab on a brew. That'd be fun. I think, you know, I'll be throwing in the cheddar. You'll be throwing in the coriander.
They're going to start aging at Apollo now.
There you go. I will get a bag out. I will literally, after this, drag a bag of Apollo out, and we'll leave it until we collab, and then you have to use that bag of Apollo. How's that sound?
Sounds like a deal.
All right. Thank you much. Thanks to the listeners. Thank you to the beautiful Bevo for handling the chat for us and making this all possible. I had fun. Hope you all did too. Till next time, brew strong.